I do, as a very quick side note, Ron Nielsen was sitting right here. I grew up with Ron's family, and he taught a merit badge class when I was 12 years old. Public speaking or communications, probably communications merit badge. And he said, when you're giving a talk, if you speak for an hour, all you need, I remember even a couple weeks ago when I was pulling all these things together and sketching things, I remember Ron saying, all you need is a one-page paper, and you probably don't need to turn it over. I printed off like 35 slides and wrote things all over it, and I showed him. In fact, when he sat here, I was like, holy cow. I guess I didn't think that he would be here. I thought he'd retired. I haven't seen Ron in a long time, but it was very funny, anyway, in that regard. Okay, well, so nuitization, I think you get the point. One of the things that my dad taught me years ago, we were building a fence, and we were literally trying to take these 6-foot slabs down, because we were putting it up on top of a post. We wanted it to be about 6 feet. We were putting it up on top of a wall, concrete wall. And so we had to cut these down, and I was using a handsaw. This was like 10 years ago. I was using a handsaw, and it only took like a few chops, if you will, on this thing. And we were doing like 90 feet of fence. And my neighbor, or maybe my dad's, probably my dad's suggestion, this is crazy. Why don't we see if your neighbor has a power tool? Or I'll run home. I mean, he lived like half hour away from me. I'll just run home and grab a tool. I was young, married. This is probably more like 15, 16 years ago. We borrow a chop saw from my neighbor. You know, one of these, done. So rather than 1 minute or 90 seconds, whatever it took to do this, not very long, it was instant, right? It was 1 second. And the lesson that I learned from that over and over again is that when you have the right tool for the job that you're trying to accomplish, the job becomes that much easier. And I think your confidence that you're doing it right becomes much, much higher. And so I analogize that within my process with my clients. What's the job sticking on point with an annuity? What's the job that we're hiring an annuity for? Well, it's to generate guaranteed income. Is it to maximize liquidity? No, because it is a terrible job at that. It's like the worst for that. You know, kind of like driving a Ferrari up, you know, snow skiing, right? I mean, that's the wrong tool. And I'll have that conversation, and I sometimes get over that chasm when I'm selling life insurance and whole life insurance. And it's a part of my, probably a part of my heritage, part of my gene pool, right, to sell whole life insurance. My dad was an advisor in our business who did a terrific job of that. Certainly selling disability insurance is a part of my gene pool. But when I think about the products that we place, I think among the hindrances that we run into is that they are commodities and products. And coming back, I think that the point that you brought up, Todd, is to what it does. If I've done a really good job of fact finding, and I know that somebody's really concerned about income, but they hate annuities, like, well, how can I present that in a palatable manner? How can I present that on a dinner plate that is not, you didn't see the mess that it took to get there in the kitchen, but it's right here and it's palatable. And you can take that and consume it without it being so distasteful, right? I put Larry Indiana on here because he was one of my dad's college friends, incidentally, and I got introduced to him a number of years ago. And when he retired, he said, I don't want to turn my retirement into a pension. So, because there's no liquidity, it's expensive, all these things, because I know it's just an annuity. Well, through this process, I sat down with him 7-8 years ago, and in 2007, he bought a 10-year annuity. He and she bought a 10-year period certain annuity. I'm not Nostradamus, we don't know what happens in 2008 back then, but what happened in 2008 and then in 2009, and then fast forward to 2013, Larry died, and Deanna, continues to receive the income while the market did this to their portfolio because we turned up the heat on their portfolio a little bit, moved it to more like a 50-50 rather than a 34 or 30-70 because they have this income, they didn't need to touch it. And now the market did this and it's back here and the income stayed here. And it's just, it's an interesting point of reference for a person who comes from an emotional I hate to an entire 180 to I appreciate. I thought that was really a fun epiphany to experience in my young life. Okay, I think we're done here. Questions on that? Comments? Market volatility. This is kind of fun too because since 1945, the S&P's dropped 10% once every 18 months. It did that on August 25th. So we're good. Another year and a half. You're good. Just yeah, book it. Right? I mean, that's for the next. No. Call me when your daughter gets home from her mission, and that's when we'll experience another market dip. I don't know if you're familiar with sequence of returns. This is actually a Morningstar report, and this is a fun example of what the market can do for you when things are going well. Let me restate. Dollar cost averaging, I believe, to be one of the great, not secrets so much anymore, but the great tools of financial planning. Dollar cost averaging, by my own or definition that I've heard over the years, is I'm going to systematically put money into the market and buy shares. So when the market is up or down, I'm consistently buying. It removes fear and greed and forces me to buy low, and I don't know if I'm selling high, but I'm buying all along. Rebalancing, of course, is helping me to buy low and sell high. Why does the sequence of returns get destroyed by dollar cost averaging on the way out? Yeah, you put a lot of pressure on it, right? Yeah. You're pulling money out, and those shares, and I did a study a bit ago, if you take some mutual fund, like American funds, you have so many shares, and if you're selling those shares, you're just, and the market dips, you're putting a lot of, what I'll tell my clients, you're putting a lot of pressure on those existing shares to perform at a level that, with more shares, it was having a difficult time doing. So this is 5% withdrawals on a $500,000 portfolio in 1973 for 20 years. And the hypothetical is you run out of money in 20 years. If you do this in reverse and take from 1994, fast forward 20 years to 1973, of course, in reverse, the same time period, taking the same 5% out, starting at $500,000, you finish with like some ridiculous $1.7 million balance, which I think is fascinating. The conversation that I'll have with my client ultimately is, listen, if we can create, and I like to use confidence, I like to use probability. I'm a little bit of a stats geek. I try to break it down so that a person can understand it. In your planning analyses, do you use Monte Carlo simulation or mess around with that much? A little bit of nod there. Familiar?
I refer to it.
Yeah. And does the software that you use have that?
I can have software that does it.
Yeah.
I just tell the story.
Exactly. And most softwares, we'll do a simulation and then kind of pick the 50th percentile of that. And I don't spend a lot of time on that. The concept in its general form, of course, Monte Carlo, if you're not familiar with it, simulates inflation and rates of return on retirement assets. And I like to use the word stress test. We can pull together and simulate several hundred. I can't remember if I had a chart that showed that. here will generally simulate several hundred. These are some back office numbers. If I'm dealing with somebody who's quite analytical, scientific, wants to know the numbers, and I'll pull charts and numbers and colors and graphs out there, but I like to have that conversation with a client to say, we've stress tested this, and I'm not only confident that you have enough money, but also the software says we have enough money so that in a worst case scenario, 10th percentile, we can stretch your money out for a long period of time. In 90th percentile, you probably are, you know, probably leaving your family with a substantial amount of wealth. And in the 50th percentile, we're going to grow this a little bit. Inflation and taxes. This is kind of fun. Who's familiar with the rule, or who can define quickly the rule of 72? So if money doubles every year, what is that? Is it 72? It's about 72%, I guess. Well, so if you assume a doubling of your money every single year for 20 years, you're ultimately at a $1 million account balance. Naturally, you know, what's cut off from the bottom of this is that's not ever going to happen. Interestingly, if you take a 20% tax bracket on that initial contribution and just tax every year at 20%, you shave off like a ridiculous amount of return. Yeah. I mean, at least hundreds of thousands. I mean, it's a remarkable, so compounding interest, I mean, that's obviously terrific, right? Anybody that took a dollar to 120,000 is just thrilled about that over a number of years. But the concept of taxes, I will spend time with my clients less to freak them out, but to guide them to say we need to be considerate about this. Incidentally, I had a client the other day who told me he's retired, and he gave me a different appreciation. It's ridiculous to think that anybody likes paying taxes. I think we all appreciate the roads and police and and the fire, et cetera, that it provides us. But his comment to me was very telling. He said, when I was working, I didn't like paying taxes, and he was a high-income physician, but I knew that I would make money next year. Now that I'm retired, meaning I knew that I can make some money, pay my taxes next year, make some money, pay my taxes now. And he was pretty articulate. This is not something that he just threw out to me. He said, now when I'm pulling money out of my retirement account, it is a permanent loss of capital. It's permanently gone. So what do? I take that, I process that. How can I convince all of my clients that taking money out in retirement is a permanent loss of capital? In my mind, I'm thinking this is revolutionary to me. What are ways that you can avoid paying taxes in retirement? Well, there's Roth IRAs and life insurance, right? I mean, those are the only two great tools in retirement that you can avoid a permanent loss of capital. And I'm not suggesting that those are the only thing, right? I'm not the whole life guy that's pounding that. I'm a defined benefit guy, a defined contribution guy, a life insurance guy, an annuity guy, certainly disability, et cetera. But I think having the ability to, in fact, I think I put that on here. I'm not going to mess around with that. This is kind of a cool thing. I forgot that I put this on there. If you take an income at 333 and at a 40% tax bracket, you can net out $200,000. But if you have the ability to pull out $100,000, pay a little bit less in taxes, and access some capital that is tax-free, again, from sources that are, you have to be creative with that and plan for that, you can create a net income that's equivalent to a pre-tax $333,000. You know, tax rates are probably going to change, that's for sure. But that's a concept that I think is lost on a lot of people, that on a regular basis. I sat down with a physician a year and a half ago and had this conversation, and I sat down with the same physician and I showed it in a format that was like this. And again, I think it's just the colors versus numbers and concepts that pop for some people, and we're moving. Like it's now a conversation that's a moving, planning conversation. Okay, I don't want to spend really any time talking about medical expenses, so we're not going to. It's expensive. You need to plan, and I put a line item on my planning analysis for health care for somebody that's probably north of 60, just to help them start thinking about that.
Do you in your regular planning with them?
Not for younger individuals, but I do for somebody that's 55, 60. I just put a line item, and I inflated it. Some 8%, some 6%. So if that's useful, yeah, I do put a line item there, and I'll look at, you know, how's your health now? Should we look at something? That's a fact-finding question. I do believe something I read, I think it was Story Selling for Financial Advisors years ago. Mitch Anthony wrote this book, and he said, never make a statement when you can ask a question. And so in healthcare, throw out that question and put that on a line item. Again, for many of my older clients. For a younger client, I'll get a little more broad with that. Okay, long-term care. Statistically, what percent of human population is going to retire, that retires is going to use long-term care after age 65? 7 out of 10. Incidentally, what's the probability that your house burns down? A little higher? A lot higher than that. Yeah, it's 300. So if Google's right, which I'm sure they are, a lot of people are relying on them. So it's like 0.3%. And homeowner's insurance is what it is. Again, sounds like a sales pitch, but here's the point. If I knew going into a home build that I had 3% chance of my house burning down, 0.3%, I'm probably still buying fire insurance, if you will, and I know that hazard insurance covers more than just fires. But the point is, when I look at the flip side of that, if I knew there was a 70% chance that I was going to need long-term care, I think that the opportunity for us in long-term care is not just the pauper, you're going to run out of money, right? I mean, I have some analysis. It's, you know, your expenses are here. And I think this is how most people view long-term care. I'm going to run out of money if I don't have it. I personally think it's a lot more fun, and I've had a little more experience, success, talking about it with people who have means and resources. And I think that the concept of buying long-term care for a wealthy person is... Well, I'll just tell you, I think that most don't think that they need it because they have enough that they're not going to run out of money. My opinion of that is that's less relevant. I think you've heard the term OPM?
Other people's money.
Other people's money, right? That was a breakthrough for me with a client that he had it on his own. I can't take any credit. It was a conversation that he and I had, and he said, you're telling me if I put $5,000 a year into this plan, my wife and I, you know, and it might have been 10 combined, my wife and I have a pool of $500,000. And it wasn't a combo product, it was just straight long-term care. You're telling me I have access to $500,000. And he did his own calculations. I ran through his things and I have the illustrations and we're having a conversation. I thought it was a good presentation, but he got to the point all on his own saying, I'm gonna lever that because there's no way I'm going to pay in $500,000 to this plan, and if there is a slim chance that I need it, I don't think I even threw out any statistics. It was that epiphany. That's been a conversation that I've had with a lot more high net worth individuals. Frankly, I think it's a lot more interesting, personally. Okay. I'm done. Any questions, comments, wisecracks?